Well, today, as I said earlier, we are going to at least try to complete our study of the Sermon on the Mount. So we are in Matthew chapter 7, and we'll be beginning in verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, my master, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but rather the one who does the will of my Father, who is in heaven. It will be on that day many will say to me, my master, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons, and in your name do many wonders? Then I will answer them, saying, I've never known you. Depart from me, you workers of evil. Or your translation may say, you workers of lawlessness. Verse 24. So anyone who hears these words of mine and does them, I will compare to a wise man who built his house on a rock. The rain fell, the streams flooded, the winds blew, and they touched that house, but it did not fall, because it was founded upon the rock. But whoever hears these words of mine but does not do them, I will compare to a foolish man who built his house upon the sand. The rain fell, the streams flooded, the winds blew, and they encountered that house. It fell, and its collapse was great. When Yeshua finished saying these words, the crowd was astonished by his teaching, for he was teaching them as a man of authority and not like the scholars. These are very familiar words that we've all learned from the time we were in Sunday school or Sabbath school, whichever the case may be. But sometimes familiarity causes us not to pay so much attention to things. We think we understand it, we think we know it, because we're familiar with the words. But I hope when we take a fresh look at it this morning, maybe you'll see things in a different way, and in a way that will be life-changing for you. I know it has been for me. Now, what Yeshua is referring to here is the coming of his kingdom. And you know how it is. If someone famous or well-known comes into a room, there's always the groupies who want to run up and be close to them and tell them, I've read all your books, or I've bought all your CDs, or I've seen all your movies. And can you imagine when the Messiah comes, the groupies run up, oh, my master, welcome, it's so good to have you here, we've waited so long. But he's going to look at them and say, who are you? Do we have a relationship together? And what is the basis of that relationship? Now, before I go further, I wish if there was one thing where I could just flip a switch and change everyone's paradigm, it would be this. To be able to read the words of Yeshua and of Paul without this hell-centric thinking. Because when we read these words, we interpret everything through this paradigm of dying and go to hell for eternity or dying and going to heaven for eternity. That is not what is in mind here. And we will be talking about these things in great detail in a week to come. I'm not sure exactly when. But that is not what is being talked about here. He's talking about his kingdom coming and then the response of people who want to enter into that kingdom and want to be close to him in the kingdom, who consider themselves Messiah's servants, but who really aren't. The people he's speaking to are people who have the exact same mindset as every one of us. We consider ourselves part of the in-group. But Yeshua is speaking this to the people who consider themselves part of the in-group and saying, not all of you who think you're part of the in-group are part of the in-group. You may be saying all the right things. You may be building a beautiful house. And as far as we know, the house of the wise man, the house of the foolish man, looked identical. It was the hidden part, the foundation underneath, that would be revealed. So, let's take a look. Now, your translation may say, my Lord, my Lord. The word Lord means master. It's what a slave calls his owner, calls him master, calls him Lord. And Yeshua said in Luke 6:46, why do you call me master, master, and not do what I tell you? If you're not doing what Yeshua commands you to do, then he's not your master, no matter how much you may call him that. John 15:14. You are my friends if you do what I command you. Now that would sound really weird coming from anybody else. Could you imagine me saying to one of you, you know what, you say, let's be friends. I'll say, well, I'll be your friend and you'll be my friend if you do everything I tell you to do. Otherwise, it's off. But see, with the Messiah, friendship is based on your obedience. It's not based on grace. You say, wait a minute, Grant, our salvation is based on grace. Yes, it is. But your reward is based on your works. Your friendship with God is based on your obedience. Your intimacy is based on how you take His words to heart and make His will your will. That is what makes intimacy. You see, two people can be married and not have intimacy. They may have signed some kind of contract. But unless the one spouse takes the other spouse's will to heart and wants to do what pleases that other, and they know what pleases that other person, unless they seek to do that, there's no intimacy there. You have to know your spouse, know what pleases them, listen to their words, and fulfill them the best you can. And if that works in marriage, that's because it's a reflection of the relationship God wants to have with us. I happen to come across this quote. It's from an Orthodox rabbi. His name is Shimshon Pinkus. He's a living rabbi, ultra-Orthodox. And you'd think he was messianic to read what he says. It says, we want to hold on to those personal points that mean a lot to us. And we don't want Adonai to touch them. There are certain things we want to hold on to and do our way. We don't want God messing with it. He says, a Jew with an attitude like this is missing the main purpose of his life in this world. When he gets over there, Adonai will say to him, so to speak, we met over a period of 70 or 80 years, but we never got married. Therefore, we don't have any relationship with one another. The person will be shocked to hear Adonai say this and will respond, but I learned Torah. I prayed 3 times a day. I even kept some of the commandments. Adonai, does all this mean nothing to you? And Adonai will respond, this is not a marriage. We never had a relationship in which you completely gave your life to me. You never reached the point where everything else in the world was of secondary importance, and you are willing to give it up for me. As George MacDonald said, the great Scottish writer and preacher and poet, one of my favorites, he said, Yeshua didn't come and die so that we would not have to die, but so that our death could be like his. In other words, when Yeshua came, he came to die out of love, and he gave everything for us. We need to die to self every day out of love for him, and we need to give everything to him. A slave does not dictate terms to the one who purchased him. And the slave says, well, listen, I don't make coffee and I don't do dishes. I get a 15-minute break every 2 hours, and I knock off at 5. Oh, and Friday night's my bowling night. I'm off duty. You know, he doesn't dictate terms to his owner. And you're not your own. You've been bought with a price. You do not dictate terms to your owner, your redeemer, saying, well, this is what I do, but after that, my time is my own. My life is my own. No, it's not. No, it isn't. Yeshua gave his life completely. He expects us to do the same. You know, during the Torah service, Brad counted the Omer. Some of you may not be familiar with this, but the Torah commands us that starting with the day after Passover, we count day 1, day 2, day 3. And we do that for 49 days, for 7 weeks. And then comes Shavuot, or Pentecost, as it's called in the Greek. And so today is day 7 of counting the Omer. And During this time, one of the traditions is, and the men who will be leading the second part of the prayer service each week, over the next several weeks, they'll be reading from a tractate called Perkei Avot, which means the ethics or the verses of the fathers. This particular writing is quoted about 150 times in the New Testament scriptures. It's quoted by Yeshua, by John, by Paul, by just about everybody who has any input into the Greek scriptures. They've quoted this. And it's an amazing work. And it was intimately familiar to the ones who wrote the apostolic scriptures. It says, Shimon used to say, all my life I grew up among sages and I found that nothing is better for a person than silence. Not learning, but doing is the main thing. And one who talks too much causes sin. Now there's good advice. Silence, like my mother used to say, don't talk unless you can improve upon the silence. And But we want to put some emphasis in our Greek minds on learning, on knowing. We want to gather the facts. We want to get all the theology right, blah, 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 blah. But doing is what matters. Because doing is how you produce fruit. What comes out of your life that can nourish others is the doing. And Perkei Avot puts an emphasis on this. Now let's home in on the verses we just read. With verses 21 and 22. Not everyone who says to me, Master, Master, will enter the kingdom of heaven. But the one who does the will of who? My Father. Where do you find the Father's will? Where is it recorded? In the Torah. How can you possibly do the Father's will by ignoring the Torah? But the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Master, Master, did we not prophesy in your name? Cast out demons in your name? Do many mighty works in your name? But he says, it's the one who does the will of my Father who comes into the kingdom. Yeshua said, no man comes unto the Father but by me. He did not say, you have no need of the Father because now you've got me. He did not come to replace the Father or to eclipse the Father, but to make a way to the Father. But somehow we've lost sight of that. And I don't want to take one single, God forbid I take anything away from Yeshua, our precious Messiah and Redeemer. But if we stop with him and don't get to know the Father and obey the Father, have an intimate relationship with the Father, then what Yeshua came to accomplish is a failure. Because he wants us to know his Father and be intimate with his Father. That's why he calls us brothers, because we have the same Father. You understand what I'm saying? And so somehow these people, these groupies, have so focused on doing things in the name of Yeshua and focused on Yeshua, they have no knowledge of the Father. And they have not been doing the will of the Father. And also notice what they've done. They prophesied, we've prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, done many mighty works in your name. You notice that all these three have in common? They're works of power, but not of righteousness. They're works that can be seen by men, but they're not works that come from an intimate relationship with God. You know, this is what, if you're listening, taking notes, this is what I want on my tombstone. If you think I deserve it, and this is what I want the words to be, have my name, have the years I was born and died. And this, he lived an ordinary life with excellence. I don't want to be a celebrity. I want to live an ordinary life, being a husband to my wife, a father to my kids, a neighbor to my neighbors, a brother to you. And that's it. I just want to do just the thing, the 1 acre plot God's given me to live. I just want to do that. I do not aspire for celebrity. One time I did, and what a waste that is. And I think we do a great disservice to other believers by promoting them to celebrity status. And I don't think God's impressed with celebrities. We should not be either. We should each be trying to live an ordinary life with excellence. So many times I talk to young believers, young men, young women, boys and girls, and they're trying to figure out this great thing that God wants them to do in life. And I just, it's like, maybe he doesn't have any great thing for you to do. Well, what makes you think he's got some great thing for you? Maybe he just wants you to be the best custodian, machinist, typist, housewife, mailman, whatever it is you can be. Maybe he doesn't want you to be famous. He just wants you to live your life that he's given you to do for him and do it with excellence, with great excellence. But they get so distracted from real life because they're chasing some kind of thing. They want their picture on an album, a record album, or their name on the cover, or face on the cover of a book, or some great evangelist, some great speaker, some great missionary. Well, if he wants you to do that, that's up to him to show you. It's not your job to pursue that. Just live an ordinary life with excellence. Carla, I see your hand up. And if you're visiting, you're welcome to ask questions and share comments. Yes, go ahead. Say that one more time. We cannot. You're absolutely right. Carla says we cannot measure the ramifications. I only stick to three-syllable words or less. All right. When you get up to five-syllable words, okay, ramifications. We can't measure the ramifications of what we do. You know, in the Torah, there are two commandments, only two commandments, that tell you what the reward is for each one. And one of them is the fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother. And what's the reward? That you may live long, have a long life in the land that I give you. The other commandment is, before you take an egg out of a bird's nest, drive away the mother bird, that you may have long life in the land that I give you. And the sages have said, we only have two commandments to give us the reward. The reward is the same, but one commandment's extremely difficult, and the other commandment so simple that, I mean, when you reach into the nest, generally the bird flies off anyway. What's difficult about that? And they say, just what Carla said, no one knows what the reward is for a commandment. You can't say this is the one that's got the big reward and this one's not so much. Because they all come from God's mouth. Yes, Steve. Yeshua says, even a cup of cold water, right, that's given in my name. And it says, even the way if you accept one of those who do believe in me, it's like you accepted me. It's amazing. We want to catch each other doing something wrong, and God is out to catch us doing something right. He really wants to catch us doing what's right. Let's give him something right to do, to catch us doing. So I think these two verses, though, in Matthew 7, 21, 22, are very insightful. Because Yeshua is stressing his father, but these groupies, it's your name, your name, your name. Look at all we've done. Look at these big things we've done. He says, I don't know you. And that's what the next verse goes on to say. It says, depart from me, you workers of wickedness. I never knew you. Yes, Mike. Yes. Yes, we will be getting to that verse later on. He says, if you care to accept it, John the Baptist is Elijah. But he says, the kingdom of heaven is within you. We're going to be talking in detail about what that means in weeks coming up when we get to that in Matthew. Yes, Robin.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the main thing that I come to appreciate as I read the word is he came to live a life to show us how to live.
Yes.
The resurrection gives us hope, but he came to live a life so
yes.
we know what to do here and now.
That's exactly right. Yeshua didn't come just to die. He came to live a life, to show us how to die, and to rise from the dead. The resurrection. Without the resurrection, the death doesn't mean so much. But with the resurrection, and the life that was lived before that death, makes his death mean so much. Yeah. Yes, Jim. Oh, yes, they were very surprised. I think everyone's going to be surprised in the kingdom. I think the ones who don't go in are going to be shocked that they didn't make it. And the ones that do go in are going to be shocked that they did. So, yeah, anyways. Now, it says there in verse 23, "Then I will answer them." Yeshua says, "I will answer them saying, I've never known you. Depart from me, workers of evil." Does that sound like something Yeshua would say? He says that's what he's going to say. You know, the same one who says, "Come unto me, all you who weary and heavy laden, I'll give you rest," tells other people, "Go away. Go away." Have you ever in your mind imagined Yeshua ever telling anybody, "Go away"? People who are wanting to come, he says, "Nope, get out of here, go away." And yet, this is our Messiah. So let's put these words alongside the other words we're so fond of saying and quoting of his. "Go away, I never knew you." Now, how is it he could say that? How could Yeshua not know someone? How could God not know someone? Well, we have to look at it Hebraically. There are a few things. First of all, 1 Corinthians 8:3 says, "But if anyone loves God, he is known by God." So for God to know someone means you have to love him. Because in Hebraic thought, to know something is to be one with it. This is why I'm so unimpressed by people who collect theology and collect facts. Because it's possible to have all kinds of theology and yet not live out a life that's fruitful. But to become one with the theology, as true as your theology may be, to become one with it means you live it out. You walk it out. You can't just quote the two great commandments. Oh, yeah, love God, love your neighbor, yourself. But to be one with that, to truly know that, you must live it. Then you know it. There's a rabbi, I've been reading this little book. It's like you can spend an hour on each page of this little book. It's such deep stuff. He was an incredible man of God, spiritual man. And he said this thing, and I keep going back and thinking about it. And this is what he said. Says, "What we have not attained, we do not know by name." What we have not attained, we do not know by name. To know something by name means to know its very essence. To know the essence of something, you must be completely connected with it. That's what he means by attainment. It doesn't mean achievement. It means by attaining, it means it becomes one. You've swallowed it. It becomes part of who you are. And only then can you know it by name. People who want to go around pronouncing God's name all the time, as if that's proclaiming his name. No, you proclaim his name with your life, not just with your lips. People want to go about telling everyone about Jesus, but they live like the devil. They don't know Yeshua by name, even though they can spell it. They don't know him. Because they have not attained him yet. They have not connected with him, become one with him yet. They don't know him by name. Also, Psalm 1:6. "For Adonai knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish." So there's this knowledge, this awareness, this connection with people who are righteous, who have given themselves to the Lord, who love God, who obey his commandments from their heart. These are the people who know God and are known by him. Now, the latter part of that verse, depart from me, you workers of, some will say evil. If you have the Delitzsch Gospels, it says workers of evil. Other translations will generally say workers of lawlessness. Which is it? Well, Yeshua is quoting Psalm 6:8. Psalm 6:8 says, depart from me, all you workers of evil. And this is what Yeshua is quoting. Psalm 6 is a very interesting psalm. It seems like an odd one for Yeshua to quote right at this point. But this little psalm is a psalm where David apparently is very ill and maybe close to death. And all of his enemies are gloating, saying, here's this singer of Israel. Here's this one who supposedly has been anointed by Samuel's king. Here's this one who's this great man of God. Look at him. He's dying. His life's amounted to nothing. But then you come to these last two verses. And David says, depart from me, all you workers of evil. And then he talks about how God will hear his prayer. And when God hears his prayer and raises him up, says, you will all be ashamed. And what does Paul say? We should study to show ourselves approved unto God, workers who do not need to be ashamed. And so Yeshua quotes from the psalm. It's interesting. Take the psalm, study it on your own. Make that some homework. Psalm 6. But in the Hebrew, it says workers of evil. And this is why Delitzsch puts this into his translation. But in the Greek, it's not what it says. In the Greek, it says, depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Now, why in the world would the Greek misquote the Hebrew? I think it's because whoever translated this into the Greek and wrote this, and Matthew's gospel was originally written in Hebrew, we know that, so whoever later turned it into Greek did us a great favor here, because they're showing us a mindset and also an insight into this translator's knowledge of the word. And I think the answer to this is how this and this, evil and lawlessness, connect. Because you see, lawlessness means Torahlessness. Because when you see the word law in the New Testament scriptures, it's Torah. Let's explain. The answer to our question is found in Psalm 119:53. Hot indignation seizes me because of the wicked who what? Who forsake your Torah. This is the key. Someone who forsakes the Torah or purposely just turns their back on it, that's wickedness. That is evil. And you may think, well, that's pretty extreme. No, it's just what it is. Think back to the very first commandment ever given. You can eat anything in the garden you want, just don't eat from that tree. One commandment. That's the whole Torah right there. In the first few chapters of Genesis, that's the Torah. That's the commandment given. They were given the commandment of being fruitful and multiply. They did do that. But the first one, don't eat from that tree. Okay? What'd they do? They ate a piece of fruit from that tree. Now, what's the big deal eating a piece of fruit off a tree? I guarantee you, if you sneak into someone's orchard nearby, and you grab one apple or one pear, whatever it is, off their tree, and you eat it, I guarantee they're not going to put you in jail. They're not going to execute you. They're not going to sue you. You might get a fine for trespassing and for theft, but it's going to be real small. So why is God making such a huge deal about eating a piece of fruit off the tree of knowledge of good and evil? Because it was the one thing he told them don't do. It was his Torah, his instruction to them, and they ignored it. And out of that one act, that one single act, all the wickedness and evil in the world has spread. All the world wars, the murders, the rapes, the abandoned children, the broken marriages, the Holocaust, all of it has come out of that one act of stealing a piece of fruit. And you see, everything that digresses from what God says to do, when you say, no, I'm going to do this instead, that's an act of wickedness. I don't care how minor you might think it is, how unimportant you might think this commandment that God gave is, when you depart from it, it's an act of wickedness, and it's called sin. The word in Greek is the word anomia. The word anomia comes from the word nomos. Nomos is the word for law, and that, for some reason, is the Greek word they chose to translate Torah. The word Torah doesn't mean law. It means instruction. It contains laws, but the word Torah means instruction. But for some reason, the Greek writers and Paul chose to use the word nomos, the word law, the Greek word for law. Anomos means not law, okay? Like a theist believes in God, an atheist does not believe in God. You understand? The word Deuteronomy comes from the word deutero, which means ditto, twice, or second, and nomos, law, because in Deuteronomy, Moses basically repeats the giving of the Torah. He repeats what's in the Torah. So it's the ditto Torah. It's the deutonomos, Deuteronomos, Deuteronomy. But anomia means Torah-less, not Torah. So wherever you see the word lawless in your English translation, it's about 20 times in the New Testament, it means not Torah, Torah-less. Let's take some examples. Matthew 23, 28. So you also outwardly appear righteous. Yeshua is speaking to the Pharisees, Sadducees, righteous to others, but within you are full of hypocrisy and Torahlessness, anomia. Oh, you may be obeying the Torah on the outside, and Paul himself says about the righteousness that comes from obedience to the Torah, says, I was flawless. But he also calls himself the chief of sinners, right? Because his heart was so far from God. It was just all externalities. But the heart of the Torah was not in his heart. He was a lawless man. Matthew 24, 21. And because lawlessness, Torahlessness will increase, has Torahlessness increased in these days? Yeah. The love of many will grow cold. You see, obeying God's Torah is a fruit of loving him. And it also leads to greater love for him. And Yeshua himself says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. And John tells us, someone says he loves God, does keep his commandments, he's a liar. Just like a man who says, I love my wife, but he won't do anything she tells him. Or how about a child who tells his parents, Mommy, Daddy, I love you so much. I have such warm fuzzies for you. I have so much affection for you. You have no idea how much I love you, but I'm not going to clean my room. But I love you. But we do that to God all the time. We'll tell him how much we love him, and then we'll go mow the grass on the Sabbath. We'll tell him how much we love him, and we'll shove things in our mouth he forbids us to eat. We'll say how much we love him, we'll ignore his holy days. We'll say how much we love him, we'll treat our neighbor like trash. We say how much we love him, but we won't spend one moment of the day talking to him. Right? We ignore his commandments. Titus 2:14, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all Torahlessness and to purify for himself a people for his own possession, who are zealous for good works. Now, if you read these words lawless and think, oh, well, Paul's talking about Greek law, or Yeshua's talking about Roman law. Really? If you look at the lives of the apostles, they were martyred because they broke Roman law or Greek law. So I guess you'd call them lawless men. But it's not Greek law or Roman law. It was to contain laws, oh, you must pay homage to this idol before you can do business in this city. There's one city in Asia Minor. They had this big arch. And on the arch, it says something basically by coming in here, you're acknowledging that this particular idol, this particular Greek god, is God. And Ray Vanderlaan tells the story. I wish I could remember the name of the particular martyr, but this man, he was a believer. And he had several daughters, a wife and several daughters. And he would always walk around that arch and go into the city because he refused to walk under that arch and pay homage to that god. And finally, one day, they took him and says, you either walk through the arch and pay homage to our god, or we're going to crucify you and your wife and all your children. And his daughter said, Daddy, don't do it. Don't do it. And he refused to obey their law. And he watched his wife and his daughters raped and crucified. Then he himself was crucified. But he would not walk through that arch. When Paul and Yeshua talk about lawlessness, they're not talking about Roman law and Greek law. They're talking about the law of God, the Torah. 2 Peter 3:17. You therefore, beloved, knowing this beforehand, take care that you are not carried away with the error of lawless people. These may be believers. They might even be believers. They say the Torah is done away with. And lose your stability. You want to know why there's so much instability among believers today? They've thrown away the very foundation of Scripture. 1 John 3:4. Everyone who makes a practice of sinning also practices lawlessness. Sin is Torahlessness. There you go. The Torah defines righteousness. Violating the Torah is what is called sin. The word Torah comes the word yara, which means to hit the mark. The word sin, chatat, means to miss the mark. We want to hit the mark. That's what the Torah is. Now, am I preaching you're saved by keeping the Torah? No. You're saved by Yeshua. You're saved by Him. It's all by grace. But now that you've been saved, now that you've been redeemed and you belong to Him, what kind of life should you live? Should you live a life like His? Or just go ahead and do things your own way, figuring you've got fire insurance? But if that's your mindset, you could very well be one of these people saying, oh, my master, you've come. Oh, we've been praying for you to come. Here you've come, sub your kingdom. He says, who are you? We're not one. We don't have a relationship. But I pray to you all the time. You didn't love me. Oh, I do love you. You didn't keep my commandments. You understand? Oh, but I cast out demons in your name. And I prophesied in your name. Depart from me, you worker of Torahlessness. I don't know you. You follow? You see, the Torah contains our covenant. And it's the covenant requirements of walking with God. The Torah is not the covenant. The Torah is the stipulations of the covenant. You know, when a bride and groom make vows to one another, I'll love you and I'll be with you and richer or poorer, for sickness and health, for better or for worse. And, you know, they make promises to one another. Those are the stipulations of the covenant. And when those promises are violated, the covenant is broken. The Torah contains our covenant stipulations. It tells us what God has promised to do for us. It contains what we are required to do in return. It was the covenant stipulations given to a people he had already saved out of Egypt. We just came out of Passover week. Passover celebrates the redemption of the Israelites out of Egypt. And by the blood of the Lamb, they are passed from death to life. And they came out of the slavery. They came to Mount Sinai as a redeemed and free people. God destroys Pharaoh's army. He says, you'll never go back there. You're done. Your slavery to Pharaoh is a done thing. Never again. Now, here's what I require of you. I'm your owner now. I'm your master. My rules are different from Pharaoh's. My rules will bring you life. But if we're going to have a covenant here, these are the rules. And those rules have never changed. I'm real tempted to get... I got time. When you read in Exodus, you'll find I think it's right around Exodus, I'm probably going to get this wrong. I'm going to guess right around chapter 24, around chapter 24 to 27, right in there. God gives Moses the foundation of the commandments, the basic foundational commandments, not just the 10, but also others past that in chapters 21, 22, 23, and so on. And Moses writes them all into a book. And then he takes the blood of a sacrifice, and he takes it, and with, I think he uses hyssop, and he reads the book in front of the people. And they said, everything God has said, we will hear and we will do. And he sprinkled the blood on the people and says, this is the blood of the covenant. All right? Sprinkles it on them. But how did they do with keeping that covenant? Not too well. And so in Jeremiah 31, God says, we need a new covenant. They didn't do too well keeping the covenant before. So in Jeremiah 31, he says this. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house. This is the only place the word Brit Hadashah, the phrase Brit Hadashah, new covenant, is found anywhere in the Hebrew scriptures. This is the only place. I will make a Brit Hadashah, a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not like the covenant which I made with their fathers the day I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant which they broke. There was nothing wrong with the covenant. Something wrong with the people. They couldn't keep the covenant. They just didn't keep it. Although I was a husband to them, declares Adonai. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares Adonai. I will put my Torah within them, and on their heart I will write it. Same Torah, new covenant. New agreement to keep the Torah. So what does Yeshua do at that Passover Seder? He takes the cup of redemption, the third cup, the cup after the meal. He says, this is my blood of the new covenant that's shed for you. He says, drink it. He didn't sprinkle it on them like Moses did with the first covenant. He says, you drink it. It goes on the inside this time. Through Yeshua, our hearts have been broken. Through Yeshua, our hearts have been made alive. Through Yeshua, we have a heart that loves God and wants to obey Him and please Him. A new heart to keep a new agreement to obey His commandments, to keep the stipulations of His covenant. All right? Remember, the Torah is not the covenant. The covenant is the agreement to keep the Torah. And there's a new agreement to keep these commandments. And if you know Yeshua, you should have a love for God where you want to give your life to Him and you want to pour it out for Him completely. Well, then he says, this is how you live. This is my will for you. And sin is Torahlessness. Righteousness is obeying the Torah out of love for me. It's very simple. It's very clear. Yes, David.
I just found that in discussions that emphasize keeping Torah, it's just so easy to focus on the outside of that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So even in a discussion, for example, about Adam and Eve's sin, I mean, we could look at that as an act of theft from which all other,
yes,
you know, ills come. Or we could look at the pride and rebellion that was in their heart that came before the act of theft. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I
understand what you're saying. I get it. I'm trying to think of how I'm going to word this so people who are listening to the recording can catch what you're saying, David. I think what you're alluding to is the fact that people can get focused on the externalities of obeying commandments, keeping the Sabbath, eating kosher, and keeping the holy days, and yet they have a heart far from God. I agree. And it's always this matter of balance, left, right, physical, spiritual. And when I meet Christian brothers and sisters who have a sincere love for God, and yet there's instability in their lives, and they just can't figure out what's missing, I say, Why don't you try keeping his commandments? If you love him, let's keep his commandments. On the other hand, I meet people who are Jewish or in the Messianic awakening, and they're focused on keeping commandments, but their lives are not attractive. It always comes down that they don't love God. They don't love their neighbor. They're not putting the heart behind the external. So it's like this. Do you want to have good physical health? Do you want to have good physical health? Yes. Does that mean you totally ignore the mind and the soul? No. You want to have good mental health and spiritual strength and wisdom, right? Does that mean you can ignore the body? Of course not. We are human beings. We are made of body and spirit mixed together. Physical and spiritual coming together. And so we must address both. And the Torah addresses both. The greatest commandments are love God with all your heart, soul, strength, love your neighbor as yourself. But there also has to be this physical follow-through. If I love God, shouldn't I follow his commandments? If I love my neighbor, shouldn't I do it according to God's commandments? If I am a temple for his spirit, shouldn't I do what's right for this temple and obey his commandments? His commandments infuse and cover every area of my life, spirit, soul, and body. So yeah, we have a tendency as human beings to always fall out of balance one way or the other. We always want to go over into the legalistic physical extreme or go into the spiritual kind of a mystical extreme where we just let the body go to pot. We ignore everything physical. We're both. This is what the kingdom of God is, the physical and spiritual coming together in health and in balance. And that is what Yeshua talks about. That's what everything in the scriptures is about. It's about bringing the two together. All right? So I'm glad you brought that up because I'm sure other people were probably thinking that too. Tim, yes.
When those times come where there's that imbalance, I try to remember the part that you just mentioned earlier. We will do, and then we will hear. So yes. If the heart isn't in it, if I'm having a hard time with that, I can still just do it, trusting that at some point I will then understand in the heart.
Yes. You bring up a great point. In one place, the people say, we will do and we will hear. That seems out of order. But sometimes, like you said, you have to do it before you can really understand it. Another place, they say, we will hear and we will do. And I think you have to do both. Sometimes you just have to obey to be able to hear what's really being said. Other times you have to hear and then you have to obey. It's a left-right. It's back and forth all the time. That's how we walk. One scientist described walking as a controlled stumble. And that's true. You think about how you walk. You're basically falling forward and catching yourself right before you hit the dirt. And then you fall forward again and catch yourself on the other leg before you hit the dirt. It's a controlled stumble. And that's what walking with God is. And it's always catching, keeping balance, getting the strength under there, physical, spiritual, all the time, back and forth. But we want to go to one extreme or the other. We tend to be extremists. Sin tends to make us extremist. Yes, Tony.
On lawlessness here, this morning I was reading again, Ephesians 2, I feel really helps us understand lawlessness.
Ephesians 2, absolutely. Yeah. Tells us as Gentiles our relationship with the covenant. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless we understand God, and then he shows that we have learned to live a lawless life, and now Christ comes, and that we're trying to do his will, and we want to perform these miracles, but still hold on to our lawlessness.
Yes.
Because we don't recognize it.
Yeah.
So what kingdom are we accepting?
A good point. Very good point. Thank you for sharing that. All right, I'm going to move on. I see a hand up here. Yes, go ahead. Then we're going to move on to the wise man, the foolish man. Go right ahead.
I got a question.
Sure.
Most people said, I did this in your name, I did that in your name. They really believe that they did, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do you think it's like the spirit of Antichrist, and therefore faith, miracles, and faith, prophecy, imitation?
These things that they did in Messiah's name, were they fake or not? Yes, some of them were. When it comes to the prophesying, Jeremiah 14:14 says, "And Adonai said to me, the prophets are prophesying lies in my name. I did not send them, nor did I command them to speak to them. They are prophesying to you a lying vision, worthless divination, and the deceit of their own minds." On the other hand, I know of people, I know Jim back here, Pastor Jim, we know of an individual who, no question about it, had the gift of prophecy. But he had some very severe moral issues in his life. Yeah. We are very complex people. We can have holy and unholy mixing together in our lives. And we probably all do. When it comes to casting out demons, there are people who cast out demons who don't know Yeshua and don't know God, but they're able to do it. I don't know quite how it works. But I know in Luke 10:20, Yeshua tells his apostles, says, "Do not rejoice that the spirits are subject to you, or rejoice that your names are written in heaven." You know? And so the man of lawlessness himself, the Antichrist, he'll do all kinds of signs and wonders. And they'll be very deceptive. So, how does it work? I don't know.
Do you think it's because they use the word and then act that way? It's not because of that?
It could be. God will use truth even in the mouth of a donkey. I've had conversations with people, maybe some of you, and they'll talk about a particular group or a particular denomination or even a cult. And they say, how did anything good come out of that? I mean, they're teaching lies, lies, lies. How could anything come? And I remember the first time I had this conversation, I looked out at the parking lot. Now, right? It's all asphalt, right? It's all paved over. And yet there's some cracks in that asphalt. Wherever there's a crack, you see grass and dandelions poking up. Life will burst forth with any opportunity. And some denominations and religions and cults, they're just all asphalt. But wherever there's a crack where a little light and truth can come through, there'll be some life. God will use the cracks in their deceit to bring forth some light and truth. He just does. That's how God works. And so with these people, amidst all the deception, God can still use it. Praise God, he can use faulty things, or he couldn't use anybody, could he? Okay, let's move on a bit. He talks about the wise man and the foolish man. One builds his house on the sand and one on the rock. Now, the odd thing is that in Israel, you don't see houses built on the seashore. Some modern buildings, yes, but throughout the centuries, they don't find any homes built real close to the water because the Jewish people traditionally have not liked the water. That's why there are so very few fishermen in ancient Galilee. They considered the water to be the mouth of hell, the mouth of Hades. And we'll be talking about that more in future teachings. They did not like the water. They did not build on the sand close to the water. So what's Yeshua talking about? Well, down in the desert where the shepherds live, in the Negev, here's a picture of the Negev of Israel. You've got these cracks in the ground called wadis. Can you see that one? I'll blow it up a little bit there. It's a wadi. And down at the bottom of these wadis, they're carved out by the rushing of the water during the rainy season. And down at the bottom of these wadis, you can find little pools of water. You'll find grass and things growing down there. It looks green. You'll find bits of water. But you know what the number one cause of death is in the desert in Israel? Number one cause of death in the desert. It's not dehydration, it's not starvation, it's not exposure, it's drowning. Every year in Israel, there are at least one or two people who die from drowning. Because what they'll do is they'll go down into one of these wadis to explore. And miles away, maybe 40 miles away, rain is falling. There's not a cloud in the sky where you're at, but miles away, rain will start to fall. As you can see here, the water gushing down that waterfall, right down into the wadi. And then down here, you see all this brown water down in here. And a flash flood, boom, like that, will come along and boom, kill anything in its path. When David, in Psalm 23, says that the Lord's my shepherd, and he goes on and says, and he leads me by the still waters. What that means is the shepherd will find waters that are safe. He won't take him down in the wadi where you can see water right there saying, come and drink me. He won't take you there because then a flood can come along and just can destroy the flock. He'll find waters that are safe, still waters, living waters. And so at the bottom of a wadi, you might see some water like this, but just seconds later, it can turn into that. Sometimes they don't even find the bodies of the hikers who are swept away by one of these floods. Now, the reason I bring this up is because down here, when the water finally evaporates, what happens? You find these deposits of sand down in the bottom. You see, the desert in Israel is not really a sandy place so much as a gravelly place. And in the desert, you don't have to worry if you're building up on one of the hills or out of the wadis. You have to worry about floods coming. But down here, it's flat, and there's these deposits of very fine sand, and there's water, and there's growth, and it looks like the perfect place to build. And this is where the foolish man builds his house. But what does Yeshua say? It says, the rain fell, the streams flooded, the winds blew, and they touched that house. The rains fell, and then the floods, the streams just flooded. This is not a good place to build a house, no matter how attractive it may be. But the wise man builds his house there too, except Luke, when he records the sermon, he brings out something Matthew didn't. When Luke records Yeshua's words, it says, he is like a man building a house who dug deep and laid the foundation on the rock. Matthew leaves out those words in red. He dug deep and built his house on the rock. But the question is, why would a wise man build his house on down in the wadi where the rains and the floods hit? I think Yeshua is telling us something very deep here. He's saying life in this world is a wadi. We're all in the wadi. We're all down here. And things can look green and lush, and there's water, and you've got everything you need, and here's sand, it's flat, and let's build here. And we have no choice but to build here. But the wise man digs down deep, says, I'm not building till I hit rock. I'm going to go down through the layers of what's been deposited here over the recent past and get down to the ancient past, down to the rock. And that's where I build my house. So when this place does flood, and it will, my house stands. Get the difference? The two houses may look identical, but every one of us has tragedy come into our lives. It could be health, finances, marriage, kids, all the above. Who knows? But when those floods come, and there's no warning many times. In fact, the Bedouins out there, when the shepherds are out in the desert, sometimes 40 miles away, rain will fall. 40 miles away, rain will fall and cause death down in the wadi where there's no clouds at all. And so they'll have a big piece of steel and they'll hit it like a big gong. And this will send out an alarm through the wilderness letting people know there's a flood coming. You look up, there's not a cloud in the sky, and boom, water comes shooting through there and destroys everything in its path. That's what life's like here. If you built your house on the rock, it'll stand. That's what we have to do. Build it on the rock. What is the rock? Rock is Yeshua. The rock is the Torah. They speak the same message. They're both dependable. They're both unchanging. So let's build our house in the right place. All right? Well, we should finish the last little bit. When Yeshua finished saying these words, the crowd was astonished by his teaching. For he's teaching them as a man of authority and not like the scholars. Our Yeshua, our Messiah, is a man of authority. He's a Savior with great authority. And he spoke these three chapters, the longest sermon recorded in the Gospels, Matthews 5, 6, and 7. This is the bulk and the heart of everything he wanted to teach us. This is it. This is what he taught his disciples. This is his word to us as believers. And of everything in the New Testament, these three chapters must be right at the top, right at the epitome of everything we learn, everything we live. Or you could say, it has to be the foundation of everything we learn in the New Testament. However you want to do it. But it's got to be right there and front and center. It has to be primary and have the answer for our decisions and how we live out the Torah, how we live as disciples of Messiah in this world. And I challenge you to examine your own life. And this week, I started thinking of myself and experiences I've had. And it's almost like there's this switch inside of our hearts that we don't even know is there, but it's there. And once you discover it, start to use it. Because we can fall into a pattern where someone insults us, makes fun of us, doesn't give us the honor we think we're due, and we start feeling bitter. And then Yeshua in the sermon says, "And people say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice." How do you do that? You take that switch and you flip it to rejoice mode. You do it. You have to forgive others their sins, or your Father will not forgive you your sins. And sometimes people do things or say things, and it's like, I just want to see them get it. And then God says, flip the switch. I reach in and think, forgiveness mode. I forgive them. I'm not going to stand in judgment. God's their judge. I'm not. I'm going to continue to treat them as a brother or sister. Get the idea? What's the thing in your life that just gets at you all the time? Reach in, flip the switch. Yeshua tells you what to do. Flip it. You have the ability to do it. But so many people have never accessed the switch. They've forgotten. They've drywalled over the switch. They don't even know it's there. Well, break through the drywall, find the switch, and use it, because you can change the way you think. You can change the way you feel. You can change what you do. And he tells us here how to live the life of a disciple, how to live a life like Messiah's. But what you've got to do is reach in and do it each time, over and over and over again. In fact, you should live your whole life with one hand on the switch. Because it likes to default to the off position. You've got to flip it back on. When it comes to anger, what does he tell us about anger? He says the person who's angry with his brother, he's in danger of the judgment. In fact, he's in danger of the fires of Gehenna. Flip the switch back. No anger. That switch goes off. No anger. Not going to get angry about this. No, a humble man, you can't make angry. The only way a humble man ever becomes angry is on behalf of another. When Yeshua made the cord and the whip of cords and drove the money changers out of the temple, no, it wasn't because of him. His zeal for his father's house consumed him, it says. He was angry on behalf of another, but never on behalf of himself. You understand? So wherever you find yourself losing your temper, getting angry, God's saying, you don't have any humility in this area. Flip it. Okay. I'm going to let the anger be my teacher. I'm going to let the insult be my teacher. I'm going to let this low-life scum be my teacher. Because it's sent by God. And I forgive him. I'm not going to judge him. I'm not going to be angry. And he might poke me and stab me, but out of that's going to come love and forgiveness. That's what's going to come out. You get the choice. And Yeshua is reminding us in these two chapters, these are the choices you have, and these are the choices you can make. Now make them. Do them. Or else you're a fool. You might have the whole sermon memorized, but if you're not doing the words I give you, you're a fool. But if you hear these words of mine and do them, you're a wise man. You want to be a wise man or a fool? All right? I think we all want to be wise. Our wisdom is not based on just knowing, but on doing what we know. If you're not doing what you know, then according to Yeshua, you're a fool. I don't want to say you'd be fools, right? Don't want to be a fool. So let's close in prayer. Our Father and King, thank you so much for these words of wisdom that come from the lips of Yeshua. Lord, help us to be wise men, not in just knowing Yeshua's words, but in doing them. Help us to dig down through all the shifting sands to the rock that does not change. Help us to build on the rock of Messiah, the rock of your word, the rock of who you are. And Lord, as much as we love Messiah, I pray that in him we would see you. where we would come to know you, our Father and our King. And that Yeshua would be pleased because his mission has been accomplished in our lives, that through him we have come to you. So, Lord, I pray we would make your will more important than our own. And we'd be careful to obey your commandments. We're all so faulty in this. But, Lord, out of love for you, help us to be obedient servants. For we're not our own. We're bought with a price. We belong to you. You've redeemed us. So, Lord, let us not commit the sin of theft, of withholding from you what you have bought and paid for. So thank you, Father, for the life of freedom and joy and security that comes from being your bondservant. That is a high calling. And I pray that each of us, as bondservants of our God, would live ordinary lives with excellence. This is my prayer. And I pray you'd use these things we've learned to make us the people you want us to be. We ask in Yeshua's name. Amen. Well,